Well, have we solved the world's problems yet? We've discussed a few of them, haven't we? It's a common question when issues of importance are discussed. Most of those types of discussions end in some sort of deadlock or circular reasoning. We might end up resolving that the best thing to do is to just avoid those type of conversations altogether, discussing the world's problems. We all have a self-preservation technique that causes us to want to minimize problems and maximize our situation. And pain and fear, which are emotions that can be stirred up as a result of conversations and discussing problems that we can do nothing about, might cause us to utilize a coping mechanism such as avoidance. We might think it's just better not to watch the news, better not to know what's going on. We might want to avoid thinking about what's going on around the world, about what occurs on a daily basis. We might prefer to think only happy, nice, pleasant thoughts. But to do so ignores the plight of the rest of the world, most of the rest of the world. And today we are going to further discuss what is going on in the world. And then we will discuss why this day and the events that this day represents can bring us such hope. It's a day of hope. This is a pivotal day. So let's take a look at a little bit more of a global perspective. The United States, after all, is only 5% of the population. We often think that we are the center of the universe and the center of the world, and that this 5% and the rest of the world revolves around it. And in some ways that has been true over the last century, but it certainly won't be in the coming years and decades and coming century, not to the same extent. Let's talk about Russia. There's been some saber rattling in Russia and in the Ukraine. It appears as though Russian President Vladimir Putin aims to reconstitute Russia and avenge the historic humiliation of the collapse of the Soviet Union. We don't know what his ultimate objectives are, but one thing he is definitely doing, and that is testing the United States and the United Nations and gauging our resolve to intervene. And he is emboldening other countries and other interest groups, you might say, to test that same resolve. So now we have multiple issues going on. Not that we haven't, but they're very serious issues. Multiple very serious issues. And they could continue to escalate. ISIS has been referred to today. ISIS was initially dismissed as the JV team, referring to Al-Qaeda as the varsity. And we know what Al-Qaeda has been involved with in the past. ISIS really is only one of several Islamic extremist groups that are very active today. ISIS is deemed too extreme by Al-Qaeda. Consider that for a moment. When you consider what Al-Qaeda has been involved with and the fact that ISIS is too extreme for them, that is the group that we are dealing with in northern Iraq and Syria. And again, it's just one, several Islamic extremist groups. They have claimed a caliphate in the areas that they control. And caliphate, by definition, is a sovereign Muslim nation. This is a religious war. They are led by a supreme religious and political leader known as the Caliph, ruled by Sharia law. They have a 5-year plan for global domination. That is their intent. How do you fight an enemy so dedicated? In scattered cells. Mr. Elliott this morning referred to the fact that when one is killed, their inspiration jumps to another person. And they do recruit quickly, and they gather, and if you squash one cell, then they just come up somewhere else. It's a war that can't be won. Not with the resources that we have currently. And by what criteria do we justify involvement? Would it be economic interests? There's certainly an economic interest in the Middle East, and perhaps that's one reason why we've been so involved there. But there are other areas that have similar issues that are social interests or plights against humanity that we're less involved with. So at what point do we get involved? Let's shift gears for a minute and talk about the Ebola virus. From the BBC, the authorities are completely overwhelmed. All the trends indicate that the epidemic is increasing. It is still growing exponentially. So there's certainly no reason for optimism with regard to this outbreak. That was yesterday. There are currently more deaths with this Ebola outbreak than all other Ebola outbreaks combined at this point. From the United States Center of Disease Control and World Health Organization, computer modeling indicates that the disease could spread to as many as 1.4 million by January, if it keeps on its current track. And if they don't stop it by then, it just continues to grow exponentially. The theme we started with today and the title of the morning sermon was Solving the Unsolvable. I think we can continue with this theme. We could talk about climate change. The Wall Street Journal had an article yesterday indicating that climate change is real. There's been a question about that. Is this real? Is this just statistically an event that occurs in cycles and we're experiencing warming? No. The greenhouse effect from burning of fossil fuels is real, and it's affecting the climate and will continue to do so. And there are complications as a result. Implications of this climate change are crop production. It will and can affect crop production because we know that if rain doesn't come at the right time and in the right way, we experience some heavy rainfall. This building suffered as a result. Crops suffer when that occurs as well. It can wipe out entire crops or hail or frost or locusts we've seen in the past biblically. So weather patterns are affected, and they're causing more extreme weather conditions, flooding and drought. Can this be fixed? Perhaps. Bloomberg was doing a little piece on this week, and the reason that was cited that this would not be fixed in the near future is that capitalism and environmentalism are at odds, because it would cost money to fix these problems. Who would pay for that? Well, it's either a social issue that we have to pick up the tab for this market failure, or the companies themselves need to resolve the issue. But even if the United States implemented restrictions, and they have, we get our cars' emissions tested, and there's a move towards higher fuel efficiency vehicles, but it's minor, really, compared to the overall consumption. But what about the rest of the world? China acknowledges that they have a problem with pollution, and they just consider it part of their economic growth pattern. That first they grow, and then it's part of any civilized nation, is that first there's a growth pattern and growth period where the environment suffers until money is made, and then in theory, you can come back and clean it up later. And they vow to fight pollution as they have poverty for the last 30 years. And it's a story that sounds plausible, but yet we will continue to see this teeter-totter between capitalism and environmentalism, and likely very little will be done. In addition to that, that interview indicated that the fossil fuel lobby is very powerful in Washington. The most profitable company ever, a couple years ago anyway, was Chevron. So there's powerful reasons why we might not become more fuel efficient and might not become less dependent upon fossil fuels. We also see that these tectonic plates are adjusting. And so far there's been, on one particular plate, there have been massive earthquakes on three of the four sides of it. The fourth side, and where the pressure is building up, is the Pacific Northwest. And there has not been one there in a significant period of time, and they say that the tension is extreme, and that's the most likely next place to be looking for a major earthquake. How many have heard of the Boko Haram? There's 26 cells approximately of the Boko Haram. They are an Islamic extremist group that operates out of Nigeria and perhaps some of the surrounding countries as well. If you Google that and look for images, you'll see burned buildings, burned bodies, very graphic images of burned bodies. It's my understanding they were responsible for the missing schoolgirls recently. These are extremists that in a country where there's not a lot of financial resources, they rule because they have guns and thus power. And what they do with that power is atrocious. What they do to other people, very sad. There's very little in terms of resources to combat them. And so there isn't a major reason for other countries to get involved at this point. So it doesn't appear as though there is an end in sight. It's somewhat unsolvable at this point, you might say. We can and will take a look at some statistics regarding our domestic perspective. Now, I admit that these statistics are not as interesting as those Mr. Knutson, Rio, talked about earlier today. But you might find them interesting nonetheless. Population of the United States is 319 million. Very accurate. 4 billion people live on less than $5 a day. 4 billion people in the world. 12.5 times the United States. So think of the United States. Think of 12 United States. And the entire population's living on less than $5 a day. Let me read you a little bit about what their lives are like. So we further will segment these, what's referred to as the base of the pyramid. The majority of the world's population, 4 billion out of 7 plus billion, that live on less than $5 a day. We'll start with low income. Now, low income is defined as those in the 1.4 billion, roughly, who live on $3 to $5 a day. They typically have a couple of years of secondary education and the skills needed to enter the job market. Many earn semi-regular incomes as construction workers, traders, drivers, or low-level staff in public or commercial establishments in other parts of the world. They conduct their transactions in both formal and informal markets. Families in the $3 to $5 segment often own such consumer goods as bicycles, televisions, and cell phones. They strive for higher education and steadier, better-paying work. As they do, they need good housing and access to credit and to healthcare specialists. Many of them have a reasonable hope that they or their children will achieve a modestly higher living standard than they currently enjoy. They have some hope. Subsistence is the next group, and this describes the bulk of the roughly 1.6 billion people who live on $1 to $3 a day. They tend to be poorly educated and low skilled. They typically have some income as day laborers or temporary workers, but their earnings are not steady. Many need improved sanitation, healthcare, and education. they can typically afford one square meal a day. But the nutritional content is often substandard. If they live in slums or shanty towns, they may work as helpers or assistants in some petty trade. In rural areas, they are likely to be temporary migratory farmhands during those seasons, but the rest of the time, unemployed. They're subject to exploitation when they do need resources. There's usually a town moneylender, and we could characterize that in many ways, but let's just say if they're not paid back in a timely way, then their demands escalate. And this is real. This is real. I've had opportunity to speak with people that are from India, and they indicate that every small town has this role fulfilled in some way. And it's dangerous when somebody needs something that they cannot provide for themselves on their own and have to go to this source of funding for that. Unlikely to reach a $5 a day standard of living, they nonetheless strive to improve their circumstances. They need gainful employment and inexpensive items for day-to-day living. They strive to have hope. Extreme poverty. The bottom 1 billion, or 3 times the population of the United States, lack basic necessities such as sufficient food, clean water, and adequate shelter. If you look at some of those images, you will see that this is indeed true. You'll see huts with pieces of the walls missing, bullet holes all over the walls, burned out huts. You'll see people laying on the ground, injured or dying from sickness or injury. War, civil strife, and natural disasters have displaced many from their homes. We talked earlier about those natural disasters increasing. Well, we hear about it on the news for a little while, and then we move on to something else. And yet their lives have not changed. They have not rebuilt. They don't have homes again. They lack sufficient food, clean water, and adequate shelter. War, civil strife, and natural disasters have displaced many from their homes. They are forced into transactions that are irregular even by standards of informal markets. Some live in barter communities. Others are bonded laborers. Women often have to walk long distances along non-secure pathways to fetch water. Just water. Poor health, lack of nutrition, financial vulnerability, limited education, and a dearth of marketable skills shut them out of the organized economy. The precariousness of their daily existence precludes participation in the market as consumers or producers. They're just trying to get by. The lucky ones receive aid from nonprofit and international agencies or government relief programs. That's 12 times the population of the United States there. So let's take a look at the United States, a domestic perspective. Now we have issues, social issues. We have drug and substance abuse. We have the breakdown of the family. Highlighted in the news recently has been domestic violence. So we have issues locally that we're dealing with. Yet, if you ask the majority what their biggest concern is, you will hear the economy. So if you care to, you could go and get some statistics at usdebtclock.org, and you could see a clock that looks like an odometer, but spinning very fast. And it's at this point, the national debt is at almost $18 trillion. Now, so that $18 trillion is not lost on us, let me redefine $18 trillion. That is 18 million million. So a million times $1 million times 18. That's the national debt. That equates to $55,000 per citizen. And since only 1 in 3 citizens is a taxpayer, that equates to $152,000 per taxpayer. We would need to be very productive indeed to ever get out of this additional debt, but there's more. When we look at unfunded liabilities in the United States in the form of Social Security, Medicare, subscriptions that have been promised, social liabilities that we have, The unfunded liabilities, now the national debt was $18 trillion. The unfunded liabilities are $116 trillion. Almost $1 million per taxpayer. And then there's these issues on the world scene that the question is, should we get involved with these things or not? Well, they're very expensive. And it continues to exacerbate the issue. I think this could be defined as some of the unsolvable. I'd like to read an article from the Wall Street Journal. This last week, it was on September 18th. It says, spare a thought for this little noticed disaster. The United Nations peacekeeping force approved by the Security Council began deploying to the Central African Republic Monday, a force which is expected to include 10,000 troops and 2,000 police. They arrive in an already poor country that descended into lawlessness during 2 years of sectarian violence. There is much strife and sorrow in Africa. Many in this room know that. And many of you have been there and you've seen it firsthand. And so you know. And we are becoming aware of it. There's much strife and sorrow in Africa. From Boko Haram's rampages in Nigeria to Ebola in West Africa. But please spare a thought for the Central African Republic, where hundreds of thousands are in desperate need of protection and humanitarian aid. I think they would fit into this category of the base of the pyramid here. The author was walking down the long, well-lit hallway of a hotel last month and heard faint sounds of Louis Armstrong singing, "What a Wonderful World." It resonated in a strange way. An hour earlier, she had landed in Bangui, the Republic's capital, and based on what she'd already seen or heard from others, this was the last place where Louis Armstrong would have been moved to sing that song. CAR, Central African Republic, had a history of overthrown governments and political unrest. Competition for power and resources has driven the country's conflict. Decades of neglected development, long-term state failure, and, of course, chronic poverty all led to the current crisis. In March 2013, an armed rebel group called the Seleka, overthrew the government. The Seleka come from the mostly Muslim northern part of the country, with fighters also joining them from Chad and Sudan. They have massacred numerous villages, killing thousands, raping women and children, and recruiting children as soldiers. The attacks created a staggering humanitarian crisis. I'll skip down through some of the other details and continue at the unrest has left CAR in complete disarray, dividing communities that had long coexisted peacefully. Schools and government buildings have been destroyed. Drug supplies to clinics and hospitals have been disrupted by the unrest, making the work of humanitarian aid organizations incredibly difficult. With roads often closed and humanitarian workers being attacked, many aid groups have pulled out. There's plenty more, but I'll continue one very salient story here. At one of the emergency clinics in Bangui, I met a 16-year-old boy named Prince Matidi. On December 25th last year, he and three friends found themselves in the middle of the violence. He said that they tried to run away, but all three were shot. Prince was shot in the back, paralyzing him from the waist down. As he lay in the dirt, unable to move, he said, rebels hacked at him with machetes. Both of his friends died that night. A family member found him hours later and took him to the hospital. Months later, he ended up at this clinic, ridden with infected bed sores. The author could not stop thinking about this young boy lying in the dirt, left for dead, on a night when back home millions of children were opening Christmas presents safe and happy. I asked him, "What do you wish for, young man?" "For peace," he said. I couldn't look at him without thinking of my own son, or look at his worried grandmother by his side and not see my son's grandmother. It's easy to perceive similarities among human beings, but in this setting, it is almost impossible to understand the realities of what others have actually experienced. It's important that we consider what's going on in the world, isn't it? We can forget about why we might want this day to come so badly. We could omit it from our prayers because we do utilize those protection techniques of avoidance and think, "I just don't want to think about these things. I'd prefer not to know." International efforts to address this crisis in Kharkiv remain woefully inadequate. Political solutions need to be found to stop the violence, but it's like trying to solve the unsolvable. Try to protect civilians, reconcile communities. The arrival this week of UN peacekeepers is only a start. As I left the city this week, and the plane began to taxi, this is the author, hundreds of children were suddenly running alongside, smiling from ear to ear. Their parents looked on from decrepit tents pitched nearby. They now live next to an airport because the thought of the troops nearby makes them feel a little safer. It was a grim yet beautiful sight. Maybe Louis Armstrong singing "What a Wonderful World" isn't so out of place here after all. The children are beautiful. Their world is upside down right now, but what I saw in their faces was absolutely powerful. That was written by Charlize Theron, an actress who has served as a UN messenger of peace and has an African outreach project as well. But she left there thinking about this song, and we can think about this day. And we can think about the fact that Christ is going to return and begin solving these unsolvable problems. One of the sermonette this morning referred to this picture, this booklet, God's Holy Day Plan. This particular copy is missing its cover, but it's orange with weed on it. It's on page 30. It talks about the Feast of Trumpets, a turning point in history. The Feast of Trumpets introduces the autumn festivals, representing the culmination of the present age of man and the beginning of an incredible time which God will play a much more direct part in world events. We will look at scriptures that indicate that God is very much in control of what's going on. He created all of this. There's a reason why He is allowing this to happen. But this day, the Day of Trumpets, heralds the intervention of God in the affairs of humanity on a global basis. This holy day represents a dramatic turning point in world history. A day which, as we consider what's going on in the world, we look forward to, do we not? The Feast of Trumpets depicts nothing less than the return of Jesus Christ to earth to establish the kingdom of God. The book of Revelation reveals a sequence of earth-shaking events depicted by angels sounding a series of seven trumpet blasts. The seventh angel sounding of the last trumpet signifies that the kingdoms of this world have become the kingdoms of our Lord and His Jesus Christ. We read that earlier. Of all the prophecies in the Bible, this one surely heralds the most exciting news possible for this weary, sin-filled world. The Feast of Trumpets also marks the future fulfillment of many Old Testament prophecies that speak of a Messiah coming as a king who will rule with power and authority. There is a solution coming. Christ will finally come to rule with power and authority, very different from the first time, which was confusing to those at the time. Well, we can read about that in Acts 1, verse 6. So Acts 1 verse 6, after Christ had been crucified, He's now been resurrected and He's back and He's speaking with the disciples. And when they had come together, they asked him, saying, Lord, will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel? And he says, it's not for you to know the times or the seasons which the Father has put in his own authority. So God will decide the timing of when the events that this day depicts will occur. But you will receive power, and you will go and preach this gospel in Judea and Samaria and to the end of the earth. Christ was a king, is a king. He came for a different reason the first time, and he accomplished that mission. The next time will come, he will come to establish a new government. Isaiah 9 verse 6 talks about this new government. Isaiah 9 verse 6, for unto us a child is born, referring to Christ, and unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder. We look to governments for relief. We ask the government to intervene, or multiple governments. President Obama yesterday spoke to a United Nations committee in New York for several hours, encouraging them to unite and address this ISIS situation. We look to the government, but this government we will be able to look to, and they will have the power to intervene and solve these unsolvable issues. Of the increase of his government, let me rewind, and his name, Christ's name, will be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace, there will be no end. Upon the throne of David and over his kingdom to order it and establish it with judgment and justice. So those that commit these acts that we've referred to earlier will be brought to judgment and justice. From that time forward, even forever, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. Should we be surprised that these things are occurring? I've mentioned before that people have asked me, and I'm sure you've received questions similar to this, how can you believe in a God that would allow these things to happen? From their perspective, it's a fair question. Why would God allow these things to happen? Matthew 24 gives us part of the answer here, or at least lets us know that these things are going to happen. Matthew 24:4, in response to the question, tell us, when will these things be? What will be the sign of your coming at the end of this age? Jesus answered and said to them, take heed that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and they will deceive many. You will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you're not troubled, for all these things must come to pass. But the end is not yet. Nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places. All of these are the beginning of sorrows. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you. And you will be hated by all nations for my sake, my name's sake. And many will be offended, and will betray one another, and will hate one another. Then false prophets will rise up and deceive many. And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. But he who endures to the end shall be saved. And the gospel, or the good news of this kingdom, the soon coming government, will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come. Matthew 6:10 says something that I think will likely be easy for all of us as we review these events. Matthew 6, in this passage, starting in verse 9, we're given an exemplary prayer Starting in verse 9 says, Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. Acknowledging that God is supreme. Your kingdom come. We are instructed to pray. We can see why. We should not forget this element of our prayers. This kingdom needs to come. The kingdoms of this earth will become kingdoms of the Lord. As we consider Russia, as we consider these different governments vying for power, and it's many. We can read in Revelation 19:11. Revelation 19:11 says, Now I saw heaven opened. These are events that will prophetically occur on this day, or it's the events that this day represents. I saw heaven opened, and behold, a white horse. And he who sat on him was called Faithful and True. And in righteousness he judges and makes war. His eyes were like a flame of fire, and on his head were many crowns, indicating that he has power over many governments. He had a name written that no one knew except himself. He was clothed with a robe dipped in blood, and his name is called the Word of God. And the armies in heaven, clothed in fine linen, white and clean, followed him on white horses. Now out of his mouth goes a sharp sword, that with it he should strike the nations, and he himself will rule them with a rod of iron. He himself treads the winepress of the fierceness and wrath of the Almighty God. And he has on his robe and his thigh a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. This is an exciting day. It will begin to solve these problems. These problems that are the result of man's actions, of nature inspired by Satan. We know that the entire world lies under the sway of Satan, under his influence. As we consider what's going on with these Islamic extremist groups, we can consider that God has a hand in that as well. In fact, we can read about that in Genesis 16. Genesis 16, verse 4. Now, it's important to understand that God is in control of all this, and that as we look back to Genesis and we read about the inception of this group of people, we understand that it was from God. He's the one who prophesied that this group of people would have this nature and that these events would take place. So we're jumping into a story here that has to do with Abraham, who was promised a son, and his wife Sarah was wondering when and if the son would ever come. It had been years since this promise had been made, and Sarah encourages Abraham to go into her handmaid, Hagar, which he did, and she conceived. And that caused friction between these two ladies. And Sarah wanted to get rid of her and dealt harshly with her. Now the angel of the Lord, Hagar fled, and the angel of the Lord found her by a spring of water in the wilderness. And he said to her, skipping down to verse 10, I will multiply your descendants exceedingly, so that they shall not be counted for multitude. I will multiply your descendants so that you cannot even count them. And the angel of the Lord said to her, You are with child, and you shall bear a son. You shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has heard your affliction. He shall be a wild man. His hand shall be against every man, and every man's hand against him. And he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren. We see the fulfillment of the prophecy, this prophecy with regard to the Arab nations and the Islamic people, the Muslim nations. That's what we're seeing brought to fruition. And we see that it's true. Every man, they fight against each other when we're not there. They fight against us when we're there. They fight against the surrounding nations. their hand against every man's hand and every man's hand against them. But God can change that. He can either cause that to cease to exist or he can help change their nature. Diseases will also be healed. And make no mistake, God is also in control of diseases. Let's turn to Deuteronomy 28. In Deuteronomy 28, Moses is writing that the nation of Israel, and later by extension all those who believe in God, should diligently obey the voice of the Lord, your God, to carefully observe all of his commandments. And that if you obey them, then blessings will include the right kind of rain at the right time. Droughts and flooding will not ruin the crops. We could skim through this, but for sake of time, we won't go through it in detail. But it says, your basket and your kneading bowl will be blessed. Your cattle and the offspring of your crops. You will be blessed in every way. Your enemies will be defeated against you. The Lord will command a blessing on your storehouses in which you set your hand. And you will store grain and blessings. All the people of the earth shall see that you are called by the name of the Lord and be afraid of you. And he will bless the fruit of your body. And he will heal you from diseases. Now on the other hand, curses on disobedience. Cursed you will be in all of these ways. Cursed will be the fruit of your body. And in verse 21, the Lord will make the plague cling to you until he has consumed you from the land which you are going to possess. Verse 22, the Lord will strike you with consumption, with fever, with inflammation, with severe burning fever, with the sword, with scorching, with mildew and other problems. And they shall pursue you until you perish. God is very much in control of these things. He can allow it, or he can not allow it. Regarding the climate, which we referred to earlier, let's read over in Romans 8. Romans 8, verse 19. Well, verse 18 says, Paul writing to the Romans here, I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not even worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. So when the day comes, it won't even be compared to the problems that we have in this world. But the earnest expectation of the creation eagerly waits for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope. Because the creation itself also will be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. So this day pictures the beginning of a restoration of the earth, these climate issues, environmental problems. The creation itself is waiting for this day. One of the teenagers last week asked if by chance a sound that was heard in some way around the world was one of the beginning signs of the end. It's very unlikely that it was. There will be no mistaking the return of Jesus Christ when the time comes and during the fulfillment of this day. Matthew 24:29 gives us some insight into what we are dealing with. And what we will see. Matthew 24:29 says, immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. Perhaps because there's so much dust or debris in the air, it will be dark, we will not be able to see. The stars will fall from heaven and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven, and all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. One end of heaven to the other. There will be no mistaking when Christ returns. Revelation 20 refers to this day and some of the upcoming days, which we will have opportunity to explore in more detail as we go through these holy days that God has set apart to remind us of these major events in His plan. Not only to remind us, but to give us hope. An annual reminder of the hope that we have for ourselves and for the rest of humanity. All who have ever lived can have hope. So we have in Revelation 20, we can read about Satan being bound for 1,000 years. That will be upcoming on the Day of Atonement. Back in verse 19, we already read that about Christ returning. Verse chapter 21 of Revelation in verse 4, as we think about these tears that are currently experienced by so many people, and God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There'll be no more death, nor sorrow, no crying. There shall be no more pain, for the old things are passed away. So there's great meaning in this day. It's a day of hope. It's a day of reminder. It's a turning point. You can read in 2 Peter 3. We can read what Peter, we can think about who Peter was and his personality. And this is 2 Peter, so this is his second epistle to those who he shepherded. And these were his final thoughts in his final letter. And he says in chapter 3, and I will just skim through this, "Beloved, I write you now this second epistle, which I mean to stir you up by way of reminder, and that you be mindful of these words which have been spoken by the holy prophets and by the command and of the commandment of us, knowing this, that in the last day scoffers will come, and they'll walk according to their own lusts and their own cares, as the rest of the world does. And they'll say, where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep," for generation after generation after generation, people have been saying, the end will come, Christ will come. "But this they willfully forget, that by the word of God the heavens were made, and the earth is standing out of water and in the water. And it's because of God that the heavens and earth exist, and they are now preserved by that very same word. And they are reserved for fire until the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men. But, beloved," he says to these people that he shepherds, "do not forget this one thing, that with the Lord one day is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is as one day." When we think about where we are in the timeline, we can think about 6,000 years of history to this point, and the 7,000 years, the 7th millennium, is going to be a rest from Satan. Will be after the events that the Day of Atonement depicts. That's the 7th millennium. So where are we in that timeline? We are at Friday night, right before sundown. We can still see a sliver of that sun, but it's very soon that that will dip below the horizon, and this day will be fulfilled. "The Lord is not slack concerning his promise, as some count slackness, but is long-suffering towards us, not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. And this day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night." People will be surprised when it does come. The heavens will pass away with a great noise, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up. We can imagine how that could happen now, right? We're capable of doing that to this earth. Therefore, since all these things, all that we see, all that we value, all that we care about now, will be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness? Looking for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which all these things will occur. But we, according to his promise, look for new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. Therefore, beloved, let's look forward to these things and be diligent to be found by him in peace, without spot, and blameless. Down to verse 17. Therefore, since you know this beforehand, beware lest we fall from our own steadfastness, being led away with the error of the wicked. For this reason, God gives us these days, so that we're reminded, so that we can renew our commitments, we can be steadfast. We've taken a look at a sample of what's occurring in this world. It's not good. It's not pretty. We can see the need for God's intervention to solve these problems that we cannot solve on our own. We're reminded of this today, and we'll be reminded of more of God's plan in these coming weeks. I wish you all a meaningful holy day season.